Good afternoon. Welcome to Women's Studies. This is Viv Sutherland, and my guest today on Women's Studies is Gloria Emerson, who was a Vietnam correspondent for the New York Times, and who has just published a new book called Winners and Losers. And we're going to be talking to her for the next hour about the role of the press in society, about what it's like to be a woman who is also a reporter for a very prestigious and conservative media outlet, and about what it's like to be a woman in Vietnam.
Take till he knows that too many people have died. The answer, my friends, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Oh, the answer, my friends, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
Hi, how are you, Gloria?
Fine, I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad you're here, too.
I'm very happy on WBAI. I feel like I'm coming home again.
Well, I want you to feel that you have a home here, because I think that of all the media reporters, you are probably the one who has generated a good deal of respect here. I know that one of the problems that we have at WBAI in dealing with, you know, other media outlets is that there are very few people, you know, who write or who broadcast elsewhere who we feel that we can respect, people who are really saying things the way they really happen, and who are really taking responsibility for what it means to be a reporter. And I think you are one of those people, so we're always glad to see you. It is hard.
Yeah.
It is hard. There are a lot of questions I can ask you, and it's, I guess, one of the hardest things is to pick where to start. I guess it'd probably be easier to start with your relationship to the Times and Vietnam. I think that's probably the question that comes to mind most immediately.
I worked in the women's news department in New York from 1957 to 1960, when I was very young and probably not very good, and was quite happy on the woman's page. I mean, I was really doing stories that I really wanted to. I did a story on the women's house of detention and prisoners, and you had a lot of trouble in those years writing well. I mean, they wanted the stories to be flatter and objective. And then I went back to the Times, was called back when I was living abroad, having been divorced, and was called back to join the Paris Bureau because they wanted a woman to cover the French fashion collections, as they're called, and I could do anything else I wanted and be on general assignment, but twice a year I had to do the great houses like Dior and Saint Laurent, had to cover those shows, and this was because it was of enormous interest to American stores. And then I had this sort of double life as a foreign correspondent for 5 or 6 years. In January and in July, I would be sitting at the collections describing armholes and belts and things that were fairly alien to me. And then I would, you know, go off to sort of cover a civil war in Nigeria. in 1968 when Biafra seceded. But every January, I had to be back on those little gold chairs. And the foreign editor, when he sent me to Vietnam, said, "We expect you to come back and do the collections." And I finally rose up.
In the middle of the war?
And I said, in the middle of the war, rush back to cover the collections in Paris. And we had this terrible fight. And I said, "I'm quitting. I'm not going to Vietnam. I won't do it. I can't do it." And you never say that to someone at the Times.
Mm-mm.
And then we had this sort of terrible row. And it was finally settled. And they said, "Go off and cover Vietnam, or we won't make you come back and sit in those little gold chairs."
Wow.
Yes, I thought that was rather curious. This will show you how they viewed a Vietnam correspondent. What they had been doing for years was sending very good reporters out, but they were also sending out kids, male young reporters who were able-bodied, as though Vietnam was a big gymnasium. And, you know, you send in the fittest to jump with the troops and follow the story about how the first Cav was really winning. And, of course, as you know, I wanted to write about the Vietnamese and had asked to go and been refused. And then finally, when I was told I was going, had this kind of very bad week of fear and confusion.
Yeah.
And remembered, curiously enough, two or three women who had set an example of courage. I wasn't sure if I had any courage. You know, I knew nothing really about Americans and war and had never been through basic training at Fort Dix, didn't sort of really know the sound of American weaponry and what calibers meant. And fortunately, I didn't know any of this, because this is what saved me. I wrote about the war as the Vietnamese saw it, as a civilian sees it, while the male correspondents would be apt to get terribly caught up in the intricacies of how a Sherman tank went through a rice field. And I would always be describing the lifting of long, thin guns firing at a village, and they would say, you know, the M60s, the rocket grenade launchers, and they would be bogged down by technical details. And, of course, they had fun because they liked the weapons. And, of course, I thought they were instruments of murder and was deeply repelled by them.
As they are instruments of murder, and you have every right to be repelled. It's the central question which will probably run all throughout this interview, and to which I do not know if there is an answer, is what is it that enables people, specifically men, to completely disassociate themselves from their humanity and to look upon guns and murder as, you know, toys?
The fear that has been put in them of being called effeminate. I mean, if a girl grows up and is called boyish in my lifetime, she was not disgraced or ruined or mimicked. But during my lifetime, and I'm in my mid-40s, if a boy grew up and was called girlish, it put him in the category of someone with active leprosy.
Mm.
And, of course, this has changed. And, of course, your listeners know how much this has changed. But in a war situation, men sort of fall into the stereotype positions. I mean, it isn't that I wept every day in Vietnam. I mean, I was far beyond weeping. The tears were locked in my knees. But for the male reporters to show emotion, to see what they were seeing, to see the faces of the Vietnamese and the faces of the soldiers, meant they would have to react and maybe write different stories. And perhaps it was just their way of protecting themselves. To have no feeling, after all, is in a sense to be safe. And so they were very much involved with the instruments and, you know, sitting in the helicopters, swinging their legs. And in a way, I think they did have fun.
I'm sure they did.
It was like a gymnasium for them.
I'm sure they did. The tragic part about that is that because they are not permitting themselves to feel the pain of what it's like to do that, you know,
yes,
to commit that murder and those atrocities. And
the more people that they saw were helpless, the more they were determined not to be helpless.
Yeah.
You have to forget the press corps in Vietnam was obscene in a way, and I felt this very strongly. I mean, we were war profiteers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we weren't draftees, we weren't Vietnamese villagers. We were all there to advance our careers, every single one of us. We were there to ask other people how much fear they felt, how much pain they felt.
Yeah.
And in a sense, we were war profiteers, and we were obscene. You know, we were supposed to be witnesses, but really, I mean, we got R&R every 10 weeks. And I think perhaps they felt this, but I don't think any of them have expressed it. I mean, they've gone on to other assignments on their papers, and they were very anxious to please their editors. Most of the correspondents were younger than I was, and they were sort of starting out in their careers, and I knew I was ending mine with the New York Times, and I didn't care about pleasing the editors and making a name anymore. So in a way, I had a peculiar freedom that a 25-year-old starting out in the New York Times did not.
That's true. My point was that if these men had been able to look at their feelings and to really see what was happening over there and what they were doing to other people and what they were doing to themselves, it had probably ripped them apart. This is something that Dorothy Dinnerstein says.
Yes. Well, I know
so many. What they do instead of looking at that is they let us carry the burden.
Well, I don't think the male press corps consciously decided that Gloria Emerson would have to carry a burden. We were each struggling to get through each day. And, I mean, you could tell the pressures they were under because when they were out of Vietnam, I mean, you could tell what the men did about letting off steam. I mean, we all wanted to reaffirm that we were alive.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I did odd things once. I had my hair washed 4 times in one day in Hong Kong. I mean, what was it I was trying to wash away? And men got drunk or found women or bought purple jackets they had no intention of wearing. And perhaps it was just easier for me to express myself. I didn't care if people called me a coward. Remember that in Vietnam, the young male press corps had to show that they were as brave as the troops because they hadn't been drafted because of class and privilege. Take a 25-year-old reporter for the New York Times. He may be only 3 or 4 years older than a kid from Tennessee who's been caught, but he's only been saved because of privilege and class and luck and being able to go to journalism school and a modicum of talent. And perhaps he has to prove to himself that he's as brave as the draftee, and this leads him to do all sorts of things. I mean, all of man's life, from the moment they are born, has to be a rising up. And perhaps the correspondents were so anxious to show they were brave. I remember the face of one correspondent when he was told by the colonel that he was brave. I mean, I didn't need colonels to tell me I was brave.
Yeah.
But God, I mean, you could corrupt any correspondent who is young and under 30 and male by having a colonel say, "Hey, Smith, you jumped with the troops," and that was pretty good. And then, you see, I learned so much about men that I found it so pitiful that I often had to turn away. I found them trapped in such an unenviable iron jacket that I rather pitied them. I didn't feel any anger towards them. I was glad I didn't need a colonel saying, "Oh, Emerson, so you jump with the troops." Because if I did jump with the troops, I remembered what their eyes looked like. And I didn't need the colonel to tell me I was brave. So that was a certain kind of freedom that I had, you see, which made me a rather privileged person in a sense.
You went there to talk to the Vietnamese.
To write about the Vietnamese and how they saw the American army and how they saw the war and how they saw what they had lost, I mean. You know, 1/3 of that country were refugees.
How did they treat you?
I had
an interpreter
who was an extraordinary man. Slowly, often with hostility, often willing to express that hostility. I think it helped being a woman. I think it helped being a woman who never dressed in army clothes. Sometimes it even helped that I was rather comical looking to them. I'm tall and rather thin, and I remember one village we went into, a woman said to Mr. Long, "What is it?" Because the GIs wore their hair long, and they wore much more jewelry than I did, love beads and sweatbands and scarves and, you know, all sort of a defiant way of showing the army they weren't the crew-cutted soldiers. And one woman said to Mr. Long, when she saw me, "What is it?" Because I had loose clothing on and had just sort of cut my hair below my ears. The Americans were so strange-looking to the Vietnamese, she couldn't make out whether I was a GI or a woman. And then the village, the hamlet, thought that was funny, and we sat down and had tea. And I think I was less menacing to them once it was perceived that I was female.
Yeah.
And would often be able to talk to Vietnamese women, as perhaps a soldier or an American male civilian couldn't.
How did they feel? What kinds of things did they express to you?
Anger and pain. And they told me what they missed. I mean, women would speak of houses that they had been pulled out of and told it was for their own good, and rivers, views, and gardens they loved, and schools that their children had gone to, and children, and men would talk of houses and porches and the sky, and they were the most eloquent people. I'm talking about peasants now.
Sure.
Peasants who were speaking in Vietnamese and were going through an interpreter. And one man, one Vietnamese, described to me how the Americans came and burned and napalmed his village, and how the house that his father had built, where he had raised his family and seen his children grow up, was burned. And he said, and all that was left after 7 days was a basket of nails. And he was a refugee, and he said he still dreamed of being in that house and looking at that garden. The Vietnamese are an extraordinary people. They're very resilient, very strong, and we couldn't wipe them out.
No.
You see, because we bombed the village, but the village lived in the minds of the people. The village of Ben Suk, for example, could not be destroyed, not as long as people who had lived there had that memory. We never understood that.
We never did.
No, we always thought our wonderful technology could destroy everything.
Let's take a break, and we'll be right back.
In the city of stars, wise men are down on their knees. The fruit man of freeway will sell you his cars when he's sure that you can't find the keys. And the ladies on Magdalene Lane all worship the sun and the sand. And the migrants who come can't complain, for this is their promised land. La 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 la. MGM Studios can't make the nut. They're auctioning Dorothy's shoes. Gable is gone, the good witch is a slut, and I've got the parking lot blues. The wizard brought Ben's a dream smiles, and he never let Dorothy doze. She died as she walked down the aisle, and all that remains is her clothes. Over the rainbow, a Kansas tornado can twist up a little girl's head. And M's on relief, and the Tin Man's a thief, and even the wizard can't wake the dead. La 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 la. The prophet has come to this kingdom of lights, but there's no one to listen or learn. And the Savior performs for the prophet's delight, while dissenters are banished or burned. And the heretics beg to be heard, but the Savior's on tour for the weak. Salvation is found in his word, if only he'd learn how to speak. And Lincoln is laughing with Amos and Andy concerning the great Civil War. And Paul Revere sleeps with the worst-looking creeps while revolution's knocking at his door. La la la. Everyone's soul is for sale. Peace of your heart will do for a start. You can send us the rest in the mail. For we have our own families to feed, and we can't let them starve just for you. But we'd rather not watch while you bleed. So come back in an hour when you're through. It's just another city full of sorrow. Makes no difference why I came. And I only know I'm leaving here tomorrow. And only the motel man knows my name.
We're talking with Gloria Emerson, who is the author of a new book called Winners and Losers, about her experiences in as a reporter for the New York Times in Vietnam and afterwards. And while we took that break, we were talking a little bit about the way the newspaper looked at Gloria as a reporter and as a woman, which was a really rough thing for them to have to deal with, to send you off to a war zone.
There were no volunteers, you know. By the end of 1969, men weren't raising their hands to go to Vietnam. And I had asked to go, and there was a new foreign editor, and I'd been to Belfast, and he was courageous enough to see that I was writing stories about war that weren't the canned military troops moved forward today. And so, you know, one should congratulate him. But he did say something funny to me. He came to London to sort of size me up and see that I, you know, wouldn't sort of be a disgrace to them. And he said, "Now look, if you get killed, I'm going to have to give up my job." And he said it, of course, semi-humorously, but what he was saying was, one dead white woman, white, mm-hmm. is worse than 10 dead men. Don't cause me any trouble. And in Vietnam, one would find that very often, that helicopter pilots wouldn't want to take you and soldiers wouldn't want you on the line. And I would be lying if I said that I wasn't grateful for the curious discrimination. I would say, now, Lieutenant Jenkins, I'm a correspondent from the New York Times, and I really have to go out with Delta Company. And he'd say, no, and the men don't want you to, and it's better that you don't. I wish I could say that I'd insisted and pressed forward. Sometimes I would say, very well, Lieutenant Jenkins, and then be so goddamn grateful they didn't make me.
Yeah.
See, the trouble was, and I've had trouble with women in the movement about this, when I came back, I was so sort of stunned by what is required of men and by how helpless they can be once they get in the army and how corrupted they are by these concepts of courage and endurance. And I also felt guilty because when I was first married and my husband would have a cold, I would call up my girlfriend and say, oh, men can't stand pain, they're such babies. And then suddenly in Vietnam, I saw hundreds of thousands of men being more humiliated and being made more helpless than I had ever dreamed. And I remembered how I said that men never could stand pain. And, you know, I'd go to a field hospital and see kids, American kids, in pain that was beyond comprehension, and the Vietnamese. And why had I ever said that men couldn't stand pain? Well, obviously, because I only knew about women's pain. But I found out so many things about men that I had never suspected. Mm-hmm. What is required of them when they are 19 or 24? I'd never known any of it. And I couldn't believe it. So when I came back, and there was a women's liberation movement, the war had so discolored and distorted my life that I could not understand the movement, and I would keep trying to talk about the risk Vietnamese women had taken, mm-hmm. and that I had been equal at last, and it was too much to bear. And of course I was talking about a perverted wartime situation, and it had nothing to do with regular life, but I couldn't find my way back to a woman's regular life. I was haunted and disturbed. And so I suppose I was out of step for a number of years. You see, I felt the women's liberation movement as it reached me, and I understand its value now, was such a class-divided one when I first came back mm-hmm. from Vietnam. It meant nothing to me that a woman in the suburb of Boston was finally going to law school when I knew four black Vietnam veterans who couldn't find jobs, who weren't given good physicals, and who had inadequate benefits. So I began to perceive America in terms of class and to finally understand class in this country. In Vietnam, provided this curious illumination. I mean, imagine finding all this out at 38
mm-hmm.
in Vietnam.
Yeah.
But who gets caught in your country? Who takes a beating? Who's going to stay down and down for good? So when I came back with this frightful and terrible new knowledge, I couldn't hear people who were talking to me.
I'm not at all surprised. I think that anyone who has read your book would find that not a difficult thing to understand, how you could feel that way. I have a copy, and I have read, I think, 160 some odd pages, and it's not because it's not a good book. It's because it is such an enormously painful book that I find it difficult to read it in more than small chunks that I can deal with.
But I hope also it's a book full of courage of other people. I mean, these
sure.
are my memories of South Vietnam and some South Vietnamese and the soldiers, as well as interviews with Americans all over the country. And I like to think that it isn't all just painful, that there are shining pages where other people's courage comes through.
That's not where I find the pain located. Where I find
yes.
the pain located is not in the courage of the people who went through it. It's in the enormous question, why?
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 The futility of
yeah.
it.
Yeah. That's where the pain is. My husband was in Vietnam for
yes.
a year.
Yes.
And he volunteered.
Yes.
Right. And I know that he has never really dealt with why he went and what he did when he was there.
Well, many men volunteered so they wouldn't be drafted. If you volunteered, you had, as they said, one leg up. If you waited until they caught you, you often got a different military occupational specialty, which means you could be put in the infantry.
Yeah.
If you volunteered, you had more of a chance of getting a less hazardous and less rigorous assignment, and so that's why many men volunteered, and they didn't want to sort of sit around and wait for the machine to catch them. And the interesting thing is that many men were in Vietnam and were clerk typists and trained dogs and made charts and put out magazines and made biscuits and saw nothing. I mean, if there were 20 men in the rear to one in combat, and there are 2.6 million veterans, that doesn't mean that every Vietnam veteran saw a massacre, saw the face of a Vietnamese villager, made a refugee, saw a city in ruins. I've talked to men who saw nothing. They sat in type for 1 year at Cam Ranh Bay, got good tans, went to the PX, bought posters saying, "We have found the enemy and it is us," had a pizza parlor, went to movies and came home.
Mm-hmm.
So we mustn't automatically assume that your husband really even knows anything that happened to him. Maybe nothing happened.
I know, but I know differently.
But you know differently.
I know differently.